From the opinion pages of the Wall Street Journal, this is Foreign Edition. Now, Mary Kissel.
Japan and the European Union clinch a huge, huge trade deal. And we preview Pakistan's upcoming elections. Welcome to Foreign Edition. I'm Mary Kissel with the Wall Street Journal editorial board, broadcasting from Midtown Manhattan. And I'm joined today by my friend and colleague, editorial board member Hugo Restall, who's calling in from an undisclosed location yet again, somewhere out there in Asia Pacific. Hi, Hugo.
Hi, Mary. It's good to be with you again.
Great to have you here. Let's turn to trade. Japan, the EU, clinching a big agreement on Tuesday. The Wall Street Journal reporting, quote, that Brussels will eliminate some 1 billion euros in tariffs for European countries annually and double that amount for Japanese exporters to the 28-member bloc, according to EU officials. Hugo, 30% of global economic output is accounted for between these two trading partners. Sounds pretty good for them and good for the world economy, too, right?
Oh, definitely. This deal has been in the works for a long time. Japan is notoriously kept its agricultural markets closed. And so it's very significant that they are opening those markets quite wide for European goods. Some of those tariff easings will take some time to be phased in, but Japan really is reforming under Shinzo Abe and his Abenomics program, and this is a big part of it for him is trade liberalization.
Trade liberalization and also getting that very sluggish Japanese economy off its knees. Hugo, you said that Abe is reforming the Japanese economy. My understanding was that that's taken quite a long time. He's been prime minister now. This is his second term, by the way, as prime minister. He was prime minister in the 2000s for a short period of time. Now he's back. But we talked on a prior podcast about opening up immigration to Japan. Now we've got the trade deal. What else has he done?
Well, he's done a lot of stuff on corporate governance. He's tried to break up the vested interests that have prevented Japanese companies and managements from managing according to shareholders' interests instead of their own interests. So that has been very positive. But yes, we've been critical in the past that Shinzo Abe has not done enough. For example, he has not reformed Japan's labor laws as of yet, although that may be the next thing on his agenda. So Abe, at least in the beginning, pinned a lot of his hopes on the Trans-Pacific Partnership trade deal with the U.S. and 10 other nations. And when the Trump administration pulled out of that, Shinzo Abe was obviously very disappointed. And his strategy now, it seems, has been to try to pull the U.S. back into that agreement in the long term by concluding agreements like this with the EU and also keeping the other 10 nations of the TPP engaged in reaching that agreement, which was signed last December, I believe. And that will hopefully create such economic pain in the U.S. as American companies are left behind that the U.S. will be forced to rejoin that agreement.
Yeah, American companies left behind. Just to clarify, that's because American exports to Japan will become less competitive as we keep our tariff rates the same and they keep theirs for our products the same. Whereas between Japan and the European Union, those rates are going to be cut. So that trade will become more competitive and more plentiful. Hugo, it's notable that Japan is
things like electronics. I mean,
yeah,
the U.S. is a world leader in semiconductor chips. But as the tariffs arise in the U.S. and there's more uncertainty about where their tariffs are going to go, it may make sense for the supply chains for electronics to bypass the U.S. and to, go between Europe and Asia instead of between Asia and the U.S.
Yeah, the contrast with the trade strategies is striking to see Japan, historically so protectionist, starting to open up in contrast with the United States, where the Trump administration is engaged in some pretty damaging trade wars, not just with countries like China that, let's face it, do cheat. We've talked about it at length on the show. But also with our friends and allies. We're currently in a war with Japan over steel and aluminum, for instance. Hugo, it isn't just Japan that's moving forward with trade deals, however. I was just took a quick look at what the European Union is doing, and man, they are busy. The EU-Canada trade deal in force as of September. In April, you got a Mexico-EU expanded trade deal. They're talking to Mercosur. That's Argentina, Brazil, Paraguay, Uruguay. I mean, they're even talking to Australia, New Zealand on the other side of the world. I mean, this is just really, I think, an aggressive push for free trade out of all places, Brussels.
Yeah, and China as well. If you look at what Beijing is doing, they're interested in having agreements with the EU and Japan, but they're also trying to hit back against the Trump tariffs, not so much with retaliatory tariffs now, but are giving preferential treatment to multinational companies from other countries, from the EU, Japan, Korea. And so American companies will increasingly see all over the world, but especially in China, which is one of the fastest growing economies in the world and the major new market, that they are losing out to their competitors. And hopefully this will generate political backlash in Washington and force the Trump administration to reconsider.
Well, a bit of insider information for our listeners. We had a Japanese official who shall remain nameless stop by our editorial board earlier this week, and we asked this person, well, what happened to the U.S.-Japan bilateral trade deal? Because, of course, the Trump administration says, don't worry, we pulled out of TPP, but we're going to do a trade deal with Japan and maybe with Britain once they exit the European Union. So we posed the question, where's that deal? And the official told us, you know, we really don't like to do bilateral deals. We don't think it's a good use of our time. We did the European Union deal because it is, after all, a 28-member bloc. So effectively, we say it's bilateral, but actually it's pretty much a multilateral deal, given that it's between Japan and 28 other member states of the European Union. And this official really poo-pooing, Hugo, the prospect of a U.S.-Japan bilateral. They continue to push toward TPP, but it does make me wonder about the pronouncements out of the U.S. Trade Representative's office and just how much we can really trust them.
Right. I think it's been quite clear that Japan does not want to conclude that bilateral agreement for the very political reason that they want to alter U.S. behavior on trade, and giving up the same concessions that they gave to a 12-member bloc to the U.S. alone, A, doesn't make as much economic sense because those concessions were given in order to get the benefits of all of those markets. But B, they don't want to reward the Trump administration and allow them to claim that pulling out of TPP was not harmful to American companies. So Shinzo Abe is playing a long game here. I mean, I think his hope will be that the Trump administration itself will reconsider. But if not, they're looking beyond 2020 and to the next administration and hoping that that administration will be able to reverse the withdrawal from TPP.
We're talking about the Japan-European Union trade deal, and you're listening to Foreign Edition from The Wall Street Journal.
WSJ Special Access gives you a front row seat to some of The Wall Street Journal's most exciting content, like The Quirkier Side of Life, a new series that features the fun, surprising stories our reporters come across.
The chief executive walks 10,000 barefoot steps every day. He recalls stepping on a bee, which put him off earthing for a couple of days, but he got back to it.
Check out The Quirkier Side of Life on WSJ Special Access, only for WSJ subscribers.
Drive time, gym time,
anytime. Podcasts from the Wall Street Journal. Check out all our shows at wsj.com/podcasts. That's wsj.com/podcasts. From the opinion pages of the Wall Street Journal, this is Foreign Edition. Now, Mary Kissel.
Welcome back to Foreign Edition. Mary Kissel in New York City. Hugo Restall, well, who knows where he is? Maybe he's on top of a mountain somewhere in rural China, calling in from his sat phone. Hugo, let's go to a place that we don't talk much about on this program, Pakistan, holding a general election on July 25th. And it's important, the contest pitting the ruling Pakistani Muslim League Nawaz Party against former cricket star Imran Khan's Pakistan Tehreek-e-Insaf Party. The old PPP, the Pakistan People's Party, also a choice for voters, but they are trailing in third, according to the polls. Hugo, let's give listeners a preview here. Why is this contest so significant? Why are you paying close attention to it?
Well, the PMLN, which is still led by Nawaz Sharif, the former prime minister, who was removed from office last year by the military and the judiciary, is essentially a secular, pro-business, generally responsible party that was doing a fairly good job of managing the economy, and most significantly wanted to dial back Pakistan's support for terrorism and improve relations with India. And the military, which is aligned with the terrorist groups and has been supporting them for decades, could not stomach this and removed Nawaz from office. And so we've had this sort of period of a year in which Nawaz has been fighting with the military, which is never a good idea in Pakistan because the military really calls the shot. I mean, the old cliche that many countries have a military, but in Pakistan, the military has a country.
It's true.
Holds true. I mean, it's essentially a garrison state, and elected prime ministers are allowed a certain amount of power to govern domestic issues, but they better not touch foreign policy and security policy. And so Nawaz, by fighting with them so directly, has caused the military to back the Imran Khan party, the PTI, which is a much more pro-fundamentalist party, a much more left-wing party, socialist in its leanings. And if Imran Khan were to be elected and as prime minister, it really would be a disaster for Pakistan because it would probably wreck relations with the U.S. I mean, Imran Khan is very anti-American. It would cause a lot of problems in policy in Afghanistan, conflict with India, and damage the economy. So Pakistan could really go into a downward spiral, which would be good for nobody. We have to remember that not only is it causing a lot of mischief in its neighborhood, but it's now a nuclear power. So we really have to be worried about this possibility. The good news is, I think, that the PMLN is not entirely a spent force. It is still leading, according to some polls, has a very strong power base in the Punjab, the most populous region of Pakistan. And, it's possible that it may be able to pull out a victory in here.
When you say victory, though, Hugo, it's unclear just how fair of an election it might be, given how Sharif has been treated. I mean, you have to laugh when I hear media commentators here talking about a quote unquote deep state in the United States. Oh, please. Pakistan is the state that actually does have a quote unquote deep state, where you have actors in the bureaucracy, in the judiciary, in the military who really are actually pulling the strings. And I think the persecution of the Sharifs who were tried and convicted of graft charges and kind of trumped up charges, right. I mean, that's the deep state. And it really does raise concerns for me, Hugo, as to whether or not these votes are really going to matter. Or if magically, you're going to see Imran Khan with a decent-sized margin of victory come the 25th.
Well, the silver lining is that all this persecution of the Sharif family has created something of a backlash, and this persecution narrative may be their best electoral asset. So voters may be turned off by this and may decide to support them. There's some evidence of that, but we don't know how big that effect is going to be. And a week is a long time in Pakistani politics. I mean, a lot will hinge on the rallies that are held in this last week, and how the different parties are able to present their message. But the conviction on July 6th on corruption of Nawaz Sharif and the 10-year jail sentence was obviously timed to have maximum impact on this election. And the judiciary and the military have been removing other people within the Nawaz Sharif establishment over the last year. So, this in some ways, this is a situation normal for Pakistan because almost no Pakistani leaders have served out their term. They all tend to be removed before their term is up one way or another. And quite often then when the next election comes around, they're reelected. So we shouldn't write Nawaz off, but he's definitely facing more headwinds than previous leaders have.
And Hugo, it takes some nerve, too, and courage for Nawaz and his daughter, Maryam, who's 44. They were both in London just in these last days and returned to Pakistan after this kind of rigged conviction. When you say that these leaders have been removed one way or the other, I mean, Hugo, some of them have been assassinated. Thinking of, for instance, Benazir Bhutto, and that's a real threat in Pakistan. So hats off to Sharif for returning to the country and trying to make a go of it at the polls.
And there's been some really nasty violence in the last few weeks. I mean, there was one suicide attack at an election rally in which more than 130 people were killed. So this election is shaping up to be particularly nasty, but also particularly important for the future of Pakistan. So I think it's definitely worth everybody paying close attention to it.
Well, you wonder who in the State Department is paying attention to it, Hugo, and if they even have the bandwidth to do it between the talks with North Korea, the summit with Putin in Helsinki earlier this week. I don't see any leadership there or even recognition of how this might go sideways. In some respects, it's similar to what's going on in Iraq right now, where you see a coalition building that could be very adverse to U.S. interests there. Hugo, one point, just stepping back from it all and taking a broader view, Pakistan was founded in the late 40s as an Islamist state. And how remarkable is it really that in the ensuing decades, how little economic, social progress has been made in Pakistan? You compare the country to the other Asian tigers, to places, for instance, like Thailand or Malaysia, or the democratization that happened in Taiwan and South Korea. And you just look at Pakistan with such a sense of sadness at the real failure of the leadership there to improve the lives of their people.
Well, it really goes back to the military's alliance with Islamists. And that took off really in the 70s, 80s. It's easy to forget that Pakistan was actually more prosperous than India up until when India embarked on its reforms in the early 1990s. There was a Pakistani middle class, and it was actually a fairly prosperous place compared to India, and relatively free market. And it's just gone backwards while India has gone forwards. And a lot of that can be traced to this self-defeating alliance with terrorist groups trying to get at the old enemy of India and make trouble in Pakistan and in Afghanistan. So, we can only hope that some future leader will be able to get the military under control, or the military will reconsider its policies. But we can say for sure that if Imran Khan is elected, that reconsideration will not happen. And Pakistan, as one of our columnists said, will double down on its delusions and go further down this dead end.
Yeah, well, Ending on a gloomy note, that seems appropriate for us in this podcast, so we will stop here. Please tweet to us at Hugo Rustall and at Mary Kissel. That's all one word. We love to hear from listeners, and we value your feedback. So thanks for listening to Foreign Edition. I'll be back with you on Friday.